the second hour of We the People Radio. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And my name is Bill Cundiff.
You can always tell it's the second hour because we're like kind of organized now.
Oh, yeah, we're ready to go.
Yeah, it's not as chaotic.
Fine-tuned.
Art fire.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Our sponsor this hour is Pape Machinery, our local John Deere ag and turf dealer. And Pape is one of the largest John Deere dealers in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington. I mean, they have
a zillion stores.
Yeah, they got a lot. Well, company-wide, they've got 110 locations.
That's pretty much a zillion.
I think they have 24 or 26 John Deere locations. So, yeah, they're a big outfit, but they're here to serve you. And they're located in Shasta Lake City at 3119 Twinview Boulevard. They handle everything John Deere ag and turf. So if you're looking for a tractor or a mower or any kind of attachment for your tractor, go in and see them. They have a full parts and service department and sales department. They can get you anything you want. Their phone number is 530-226-9226, or you can get them on the web at papemachinery.com.
P-A-P-E.
P-A-P-E, Pape.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. E has a little accent over it.
Yeah.
It's pretty tricky.
Yeah. It's not Peppy.
No, it's not that.
It's not. I get a lot of calls. Is this Peppy Machinery? Nope, it's not Peppy.
No, we're Peppy, but we're not Peppy.
Yeah,
you know?
It's Pape.
And they're also linked up on the front page of our site at wethepeopleradio.us. So there you go. I'm not going to go through the whole thing we did at the beginning of the show, but it is the beginning of the year. And so a lot of people like to get a little jump on stuff. And so if you live in California, you better get your real ID at the DMV. And my suggestion would be to go to the California DMV website, look up the checklist. If you have changed your name, because you're probably a girl, although they do give you the option to be non-binary now on the California DMV, just a little.
Can I be a furry, though?
Nope. You can be non-binary, though.
Non-binary.
I don't really know what that entails, but You can do that if you are so inclined. I guess inclined is the whole catch there. So anyway, if you've changed your name for someone.
My mind is racing right now with things I'm not going to say.
All the things that are not going to be said. So anyway, if you've changed your name, you do have to bring in like marriage certificates, divorce certificates, all that kind of stuff. So I really would encourage you to look at the checklist. Do as much as you can online before you head to the DMV. And then for heaven's sakes, if possible, make yourself an appointment. But don't mess around, because if you need to buy a firearm, and who doesn't need to buy a firearm? If you need to fly on an airplane, do all sorts of stuff, your legal ID in California will have to be the real ID, and it takes a little bit to get that done. If your passport is current, you can use that, actually. That'll save you some time. And if you have to renew it, I learned yesterday, it's $110.
Good for 5 years, though.
Ten.
10 years.
10 years. And
10 years, $110.
Hot tip on that, too. Sorry, I wasn't going to do this, but I did learn some stuff. Hot tip, if your passport is past the 10-year mark, you've got a spare 5 years, and you can still renew it. You can't use it. It's not valid anymore, but you don't have to start from the beginning. So if you have a passport, you're not sure how old it is, get in there and check that out. Because it's 2020, for heaven's sakes, anything could happen. It's going to be a wild ride. I don't know.
I was thinking about jumping on a private jet the other day and getting the heck out of Dodge, but I decided to stick around.
You're going to leave your private jet parked?
Yeah.
What, are you trying to help with global warming or something?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, my pilot wasn't available.
Yeah, exactly. Dr. Peter Vincent Pry is our guest, and he has served as the Chief of Staff to the Congressional Electromagnetic Pulse Commission, the EMP Commission. He's the Executive Director of the Task Force on National and Homeland Security, a congressional advisory board dedicated to achieving protection of the United States from electromagnetic pulse, cyber warfare, mass destruction, terrorism, and other threats to civilian critical infrastructures on an accelerated basis. So, I mean, I like all that stuff. I'm glad he's doing all that. He's also the director of the United States Nuclear Strategy Forum, which is an advisory board to Congress on policies to counter weapons of mass destruction. Foreign governments, including the United Kingdom, Israel, Canada, Kazakhstan, they consult with Dr. Pry on the EMP, cyber, and other strategic threats. So, we're lucky we have an actual expert, so we don't have to listen to some goofy talking head on CNN to find out what's going on in the world.
That's right. And get the real scoop
and
right
how
here.
It all works.
The whole story.
Mm-hmm. All right. So where would you like to pick it up this hour,
Dr.
Pry?
We were talking about the implications.
Are you Dr. Pry? I don't think
you
look like Dr.
Pry. Wanted to pick it up where we left off because it's a fascinating discussion we've been having.
All right.
And we were going to jump into the relationship with China and Russia as it pertains to recent events.
If he wants to.
If you want. I mean, it's just
okay, go ahead.
Yes, I do want to pick
oh, darn
that
it.
That's where I was going.
I was hoping you were
going
to tell Bill he was off base.
Because almost everybody talks about this new crisis in the Middle East just in the context of Iran and the United States. But the crisis is broader than that. Because Iran is a client state of Russia and China, and is a strategic partner by treaty with North Korea, and in fact, a partner with North Korea. Iran's nuclear program is all built on Russian technology, and in fact, the Russians are building more nuclear reactors for them. Their missile technology is a mix, is mostly from North Korea. I had mentioned the Shahab-3 before, which is their most advanced medium-range ballistic missile. Their most advanced military missile right now. That's the one that Iran today was talking about being able to strike 35 high-priority targets of the U.S. and the Middle East. The Shahab-3 is really a souped-up version of the Nodong, which is a medium-range missile developed by the North Koreans, also based on Russian technology, by the way. But the Chinese helped Iran soup up the Nodong, and now it's the Shahab-3. So it's sort of an improved version. North Korean scientists are definitely present in large numbers helping the Iranian missile program, and they're probably helping the nuclear program too. So these countries are allied together, you know, working together. And at minimum, you would describe the relationship as client states to Russia, China, and allies between North Korea and Iran. And just 2 weeks ago, you know, this one of the things that makes this the crisis happening at this time particularly unfortunate, and the potential for escalatory possibilities particularly real, is just 2 weeks ago, Iran had a joint naval exercise with Russia and China in their own backyard in the Indian Ocean. The reason the Chinese and the Russians did that was, which was highly publicized, by the way, you know, was to send a signal to the United States to keep its hands off Iran, that Iran is their client state, that they consider them a client state, their protector, that they have they're willing to protect Iran, at least insofar as being willing to conduct joint naval exercises with them. So, after General Soleimani, who shortly before he was legitimately assassinated, you know, he was meeting with Russian officials, and just 2 weeks ago we had Iran doing a joint naval exercise with its partners Iran and China, and so this is a challenge basically to Russia and China too. Their credibility will suffer if nothing happens, if the United States is just allowed to kind of get away with this and nothing happens. It'll also make them look weak. As for North Korea, and all of them, by the way, before this happened, were planning on challenging the United States in 2020. All of them before this happened. Clearly, you know, have an interest in the political defeat of President Trump. They don't want him reelected. He's been too strong and too effective a president. And so, you know, they were planning to raise challenges to President Trump in the United States, probably do big, scary things to try to get him, to try to convince the American people that he's reckless, he's too dangerous to have as president, to try to get him defeated in the elections so they can go back to winning the new Cold War peacefully by having a Democrat like Obama or somewhat even worse in charge of the United States, because they were winning the new Cold War for 8 years under Obama without having to fire a shot, really. I mean, that's the best way to win a war, without having to actually fight. So here's now that the United States has had to do this, it gives them an excuse to escalate the situation.
Oh, sure, because we were bad.
They were planning to do it on their own anyway. Even before this happened, they were starting to do things that weren't much reported here.
We've got to take a really quick break. When we come back, you might go into just maybe a little short laundry list of those things that had happened that people probably never heard about because they were not reported. We'd be happy to get that out on the air because that would make sense of a lot of this, I think, for people. We'll be right back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. The new EMP Commission theme song right there. Okay, probably not. Go ahead.
I prefer the advertisement for the Black Bear Diner. If I'm ever in your network, your neighborhood, I will have a big steak there.
You simply must go to the Black Bear Diner. There are many of them, as a matter of fact, so they're hard to miss. They're all over the place, and they're all really good. They're for hungry people. We don't have any vegan food there or any of that.
So we were talking about the allies of Iran and some
of
their...
You don't want to talk about vegan food?
No, I don't
want to
talk about vegan food.
I was going to go down a laundry list of some of the things
yes.
that have happened across the holidays.
Exactly.
One of us is paying attention.
Thank you.
That we're going to challenge the Trump administration in 2020. So they've already started... You know, the big challenge. One of the things we all heard about the North Korean Christmas surprise, and that's still to happen. The North Koreans haven't retracted that. They're still threatening that they're going to demonstrate some spectacular new strategic weapon to punish President Trump for continuing sanctions and supposedly being unreasonable in negotiations. And you know, in effect, what they want is us to recognize them as a legitimate nuclear weapons state, despite all the talk to the contrary in these meetings about their so-called promised denuclearization. And so that's yet to happen. And I think you know, there's been a lot of. In fact, there was kind of an absurd article published today in 38 North, which is a journal for people who follow what happens in North Korea. That said, criticized a lot of people. It didn't criticize me, but it criticized others. I noticed they didn't mention Jeffrey Lewis, who was a regular contributor to 38 North, who was warning about the North Korean Christmas surprise. And Lewis and the others were perfectly right to do it, you know. North Korea is pretty much a black box to us, and they have pretty much also consistently delivered on their threats, their escalatory threats in this nuclear realm, whether it comes to nuclear testing or nuclear missiles. Unfortunately, Kim Jong-un has been a better guide to the progress of North Korea's nuclear missile program than our own intelligence community, you know, which doesn't understand, doesn't have enough data, doesn't have enough facts to be able to, and is still our intelligence community is still largely staffed by Obama administration people. You know, and so they still tend to take a best case, head in the sand point of view toward North Korea and everything else. And, you know, so we should continue to be concerned about the impending North Korean Christmas new strategic weapon system, what was called the Christmas surprise. They never said it was going to happen on Christmas Day. That was just speculation by some people in the West, including Jeffrey Lewis. Another thing that happened is, China's got a new aircraft carrier, and they sailed it through the Taiwan Straits. Now, historically, the way we have messaged China is that we're going to defend Taiwan, is we will sail an aircraft carrier through the Taiwan Straits. So it is no accident that they did that. They're sending the signal back to us. And this raises questions about, is China going to go further and create some crisis over ownership of Taiwan now that it's got a more advanced Navy? It's basically they've got an advantage over us in the Western Pacific, because of the many intermediate-range ballistic missiles they've got that can reach out and hit our aircraft carriers and our Navy. And they've got new sophisticated generations of fighter aircraft and aircraft carriers and submarines now. So a conflict with China in that part of the world, right now we probably wouldn't win it. So that's another area. And so over the holidays, they did that. They sent that signal, very little reported. And the last, but perhaps most important, was from Russia. They actually deployed their first regiment of avant-garde armed nuclear missiles. The avant-garde is one of these hypersonic nuclear warheads that it's a revolutionary new technology. It's a super weapon that Putin had warned us about deploying last March, March 18, back in 2018, March 2018, he announced to the world that Russia was going to start deploying these new nuclear super weapons, a new family of nuclear super weapons. And this is one of them. And it's one of the scariest ones, because it can reach the United States more quickly, reduces our reaction time. It's very difficult, at some phases of the flight, impossible for our early warning radars to see it coming. And we can't also anticipate the target it's going to hit because it can maneuver. So that the president, won't know what kind of retaliatory strike options he should execute, even if he sees it coming, until the thing actually hits. And because it's a maneuverable reentry vehicle, it has great accuracy. You might not even need to put a nuclear weapon on it for it to do something like destroy a hardened missile silo, because it imparts very great cruise missile-type accuracy to a ballistic missile warhead. So it could strike, instead of hitting a quarter mile away from target, which is what you can get with inertial guidance systems like the missiles we had in the Cold War, this thing could strike a silo, potentially, right on the silo lid, or maybe a few meters away from the silo, but so close that it could actually crater the silo. The Russians are conservative military planners. They have almost certainly put a nuclear weapon on the avant-garde. In fact, their writings refer to a 1 to 2 megaton warhead on the avant-garde. So talking about overkill, so this thing could be very highly accurate and also have a very high yield to ensure the success of a first strike. And make no mistake, that's what it is. It's a surprise attack first strike weapon. And we've never faced this kind of a threat before. But it was two Fridays ago that they activated the first regiment. We're still 5 years away. 5 years away from getting the first bomber for our strategic triad modernization program. We won't see the first ballistic missile submarine until after 2030. And the Russians they've already got a modernized strategic force, but now they're getting this family of super weapons to which we have no counterparts, and they're deploying them right now. And that started happening over the holidays, and we're way behind. So that's very
worrisome. Why is it that we're way behind, just out of curiosity?
Oh.
I know it's never one thing, but...
Yeah, you have to go back to the Clinton administration, really.
Yeah.
You know, the Clinton administration, you know, was very anti-nuclear.
Yeah.
It brought people into their administration that didn't like nuclear weapons, that believed that America's security could be guaranteed through arms control treaties, through treaty processes, in negotiations. And this isn't just a fault of the Clinton administration, by the way. I mean, this is, you can go back to before World War II. Western democracies all believe in the treaty process. They're trying to sell the State Department. Has apparently even sold President Trump on the idea of going to the negotiating table to try to solve the Russian nuclear threat, the negotiations. The short story is, because the United States obeys arms control treaties, you know, we tied our hands behind our back, and because the Russians don't obey arms control treaties, they forged ahead in both the numbers and the technological sophistication. So we've had our hands tied behind our back since the Clinton administration, and now we're too late waking up to a situation that never existed in the Cold War, where Russia enjoys huge advantages, both numerical and technological advantages. You know, we've talked before on your show about how they've got at least 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. We never allowed that during the Cold War. You know, we never wanted them to have an advantage in any category, whether it was numbers or technology. But they now, today, they've got at least a 10-to-1 advantage in tactical nuclear weapons. We know the Obama administration knew they cheated on the Intermediate-Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. These are what are called theater weapons designed to strike Europe and Asia, longer range than tactical battlefield weapons. And they've been cheating on that for years. And only President Trump had the guts to finally say, look, you guys are treating on the INF treaty, we're withdrawing. And we've just started trying to relearn how to do that kind of missile technology and have been testing some things. Now, the State Department still thinks and still argues that that Russia is in compliance with the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, okay? But, I mean, since they've cheated on the Tactical Nuclear Weapons Agreement, the presidential, which was called the Presidential Nuclear Initiative, and they've cheated on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, okay? It just seems to be a failing grade on an intelligence test. You know those intelligence tests where you say, complete the pattern, okay? And so you see, I don't know, you know, a bowl,
yeah.
And then, you know, some fruit going into the bowl, and, you know, I don't know.
And maybe, then they pick the shoe.
Right, yeah, exactly, you know. So if you just use that kind of fill-in-the-blank intelligence test, they cheated on the tactical nuclear weapons, they cheated on the theater nuclear weapons, what are they going to do with strategic nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
State Department wants us to believe that they're not cheating on that. However, there's a lot of evidence that they are. And in a very big way. And the State Department just doesn't want to face up to that.
Well, it sounds like the people who are in charge of it are the same people who think that if we just make more gun laws, then we'll actually stop crime. Because criminals always are looking to make sure that they're compliant with all the local gun laws.
Yeah,
we've got to take a really quick break here. Sorry about that.
Sure.
And we will be right back. You can just hold your breath for 2 minutes and we'll play your favorite song, too.
Now, on the day I was born, the nurses all gathered round and they gazed in wide wonder at the joy they had found. The head nurse spoke up, said, "Leave this one alone." She could tell right away that I was bad to the bone. Bad to the bone. Bad to the bone. Bad. That justice is the one thing you should always find. You gotta saddle up your boys, you gotta draw a hard line. When the gun smoke settles, we'll sing a victory tune and we'll all meet back at the local saloon. We'll raise up our glasses against evil foes.
voices singing. Whiskey for my men, beer for my horses.
Best song ever. We should just play that every break.
So we were discussing Russia's bad deeds.
Well, we weren't. We were just listening.
Well, we were listening. Yeah.
Well, I should shut up so that you guys can talk more.
Oh, that's a really bad
that's
idea.
There's one last.
Our PhDs
one last
are
thing,
still
and then
in
I'll
the
get off my soapbox for a while and let you cross-examine me or call me crazy or whatever.
We've
been talking about. You know, these are bad news things that happened over the holidays.
Yeah.
You know, that have so that Russia, China, North Korea, Iran have already begun the process of challenging the United States during the last year of President Trump's first term, hoping to scare the American people into not voting for him by making it seem like, well, the world is a big, dangerous, scary place, but they'd like us to blame President Trump for all this mischief, all these bad things that they're actually the ones concocting. They're the responsible parties for making the world a more dangerous place. And it's likely they'll pull out the stops in 2020 because they were doing so well under President Obama. And you had asked me another question, how did we get to this place, by the way, where we're so far behind Russia? And that's a whole show. We could talk about that at great length. But I tried to hit some of the highlights on that. But the point I want to get to now in terms of the immediate crisis, the implications of this immediate crisis in the Middle East, is one of the things that also very much concerns me is the possibility of getting into a world war through miscalculation. You know, because it seems to me so much like what happened before in 1914, the events that led to World War One, where you had a multipolar world, and things were much slower then, and the technologies much less advanced, and the decision-making, you had days or weeks to make decisions. But even with the technologies of the time, you know, the war plans that the nations had drawn for mobilization, which was based on their railroad capabilities and the timing of, you know, picking up certain regiments and divisions to mobilize them and move them to the front. Even the comparatively primitive technology of the time was so complicated that the general staffs couldn't reverse. They didn't have plans for reversing mobilization in case somebody called off the war. And so it created a situation where a single Serbian terrorist, by shooting Archduke Ferdinand in the heart and killing his wife, that one bullet, those two bullets, started the mobilization of the Ottoman Empire military forces to invade Serbia to take revenge. And then Russia started mobilizing to protect their client state, which was Serbia. And then Germany started mobilizing to protect their ally, the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And France and England both started mobilizing, you know, because Germany was mobilizing. And it couldn't be reversed. And we basically stumbled into World War One that way because of the pressure of technology and the, for the time, you know, only days and weeks to make these decisions. Today, decisions could have to be made, like facing something like the avant-garde or ballistic missiles, EMP attacks, cyber warfare. You know, you're talking about making crucial strategic decisions that might have to be made in minutes or you know, actually, minutes is what it comes down to, or maybe even seconds in some cases. And you're dealing with a multipolar world that's much more unstable and dangerous than the Cold War world was, where we just had to basically worry about the Soviet Union. You know, it was a bipolar world. It was a simpler world where the possible pathways to war were less. They were fewer. Now we have all these bad actors. I mean, they're all working together. But they're also independent actors with their own separate agendas, Iran, North Korea, China, and Russia, and us. You know, all with their independent interests, all of them capable of making miscalculations, and we are capable of miscalculating as well. A lot of this what we've been talking about. For example, the ideological dimension of Islam, that of Iran, and the Islamic Revolutionary Guard, that makes Iran such a dangerous actor because of its ideology, even more so than their geopolitical and economic interests, their ideology. I don't think the State Department or the Department of Defense gets that today, because in the Bush administration, when we started the global war on terror, you know, they fired our Islamic experts who taught about how Islam, you know, the radical interpretation of Islam, radical Islamic terrorism, motivated was the foundations for moving a lot of what the terrorists and what their state sponsors like Iran did. That was considered politically incorrect. The Bush and the Obama administrations didn't want it to look like it was a Christian versus Islam thing, and it became politically incorrect, and it's still politically incorrect, you know, to talk about it. President Trump, to his credit, when he ran, one of the things he did is he mentioned radical Islamic terrorism. He would call it out by name. But those people who used to teach that cadre of experts who were in the Department of Defense and the State Department and were in our war colleges, you know, who would teach our experts, hey, you've got, when you're thinking about Iran, you've also got to think about this dimension, the ideological dimension, because this is probably the most important thing. They haven't been there for years. For years we haven't had people there. So I'm afraid we've got people advising the president in the Department of State and the Department of Defense who think that Iran will act like a normal nation state, and they don't understand the ideological dimension of this. I also think that because our intelligence community, President Trump never drained the swamp in the intelligence community or elsewhere, really, in the U.S. government. You know, we've replaced a few people at the top, but most of the rank-and-file analysts and middle managers in our intelligence community he inherited from the Obama administration. You know, these are people that still have the Obama view of the world, and they don't think that Iran has the bomb. They don't think Iran has nuclear missiles yet. They think they're close, but I don't think they're there. It makes a big difference if they've got nuclear missiles now versus being close to having them. And that could be a huge miscalculation on our side that might lead us to take actions that we might not otherwise take if we realized and understood that Iran actually has nuclear weapons now, which is what I think they do have. So the possibility for miscalculation here is enormous. And also on the, and equally or even more so on the other side, you know, we've been talking about the bad guy actors doing scary things during 2020 just for political purposes, you know, to try to see that President Trump gets reelected. But the situation, I think the international situation is so dangerous, they could go well beyond that, you know. I mean, the general staffs in all these countries have got to be thinking, President Trump has started rebuilding America's military and nuclear capabilities. We're still a long way from undoing the damage of the Obama years, but we've started rebuilding them. Right now, when you look at our military forces and our nuclear forces, they're still weaker than they have, almost weaker than they have ever been. They're a little bit better off than they were at the end of the Obama administration, but not much. You know, we've been investing a lot of money in the last three defense budgets, but it's going to take years to undo the damage that Obama did. So, you know, they have in 2020, maybe instead of just seeing that Trump doesn't get reelected, maybe they'd like to deal us a bloody nose or even a more serious setback that would change the world order and push the United States off of the role of being the dominant power in the new world order and establish a new world order dominated by themselves. You know, and they could do that by Russia could grab the Baltic states. There's been a very good case made by an analyst who I respect that they might grab Belarus too in the course of doing that. They've been fighting this war in Ukraine. Who knows how far their aggression could go against both the NATO frontline states and so-called neutral states like Belarus and Ukraine. You know, if they did that and we weren't able to push back, and we can't right now, you know, there's no way we can defend that part of the world. It's too far away from us. Our military is too weak. You know, even the Pentagon, even those optimists that I was talking about in the Obama intelligence community, you know, agrees that Russia could overrun, you know, the NATO frontline states in 72 hours. You know, what if China decides to grab attempts to invade Taiwan, take over Taiwan, or take islands and in the South China Sea and basically declare that a Chinese lake and everybody is prohibited from going into it? Well, North Korea could do things, and Iran might be perfectly happy to just play a provocative role. I mean, they would love to see America and Russia go to war, America and China go to war, and have the infidels wipe each other out and just be the maybe the fuse.
Sure,
they could just sit back and watch. Well, I know that we have had several times we've done shows with people from the Organization of Iranian American Communities. They have a pretty big community here in California. And throughout the Iran nuclear deal, they all said, you know, please, if they make this deal and they give them all this money, they're going to kill all the relatives that are held as political prisoners, and that will not allow us to topple the regime. That'll just keep it going. And, you know, their plea was always, if America could just, you know, kind of let us, you know, wipe these mullahs out, we could get our country back. So the Iranians who live outside of the country are not fans of what's going on in their. They consider themselves Persians. They actually don't introduce themselves as Iranians. They always introduce themselves as Persian, which is always pretty interesting and sends people back to look at what all that means. We have to take a really quick break. We're going to be back with our guest, Dr. Peter Vincent Pry, here in just 2 minutes. Celebrate a little capitalism.
That's about the way we have to live here in this country. Harping on wars we fight and griping about the way things ought to be. And I don't mind them switching sides and standing up for things they believe in. When they're running down my country, man, they're walking on the fighting side of me. Supersonic man out of you. Stop me now.
I'm having such a good time. I'm having a ball.
Don't stop me now.
If you want to have a good time, just give me a call.
Don't stop me
now. I'm having a good time.
Don't stop me
now. Yes, I'm having a good time. I don't want to stop at all.
It's mostly the Trump 2020 theme song there. All right. So, Dr. Pry, what have we missed here? We've got an entire 10 minutes.
Well, I'd like to talk about the best solution for Iran, which you raised just before the break, talking about the Iranian exile community, you know.
Which is a big chunk of people.
Right.
I mean, I had no idea there were that many of them.
The United States to support a revolution in Iran without the Marines going in, without U.S. putting any boots on the ground, but to support a counter-revolutionary movement in Iran, because one of the big things going for us, I mean, is the fact that the Iranian people, the vast majority of the Iranian people, hate the mullahs. They don't want to play this, be part of this end times crazy eschatological scheme that sacrifices themselves or results in a big war with the West. And they would like the mullahs out. They would like to, you know, and many of them were willing to do it, as we have seen, you know, in constant uprisings by the people, including recently, where hundreds of them have been killed by the Islamic Revolutionary Guard without any help or support at all coming from the West. So overthrowing the Iranian regime, I think, would be fairly easy to do if we were to supply the counter-revolutionary forces with what they need. And this has been true for a long time. 15 years ago, back in 2005, when I was on the House Armed Services Committee, a friend and a person I was working with at that time, I was assigned to help Kurt Weldon, Congressman Kurt Weldon. He was the vice chairman of the House Armed Services Committee at the time, and vice chairman of the House Homeland Security at the time committee. He was the only person who ever held was the vice chair of both those powerful committees. And Kurt was in contact. He and I were going to Paris to meet with the Iranian counter-revolutionaries. And, you know, we got to know them and their organization quite well, and introduced them, basically. It was amazing how our CIA didn't even want to meet with these guys. Dragged their feet. They didn't want to get involved in with Iran. I think they missed a golden opportunity. They didn't need much from us. And I think our CIA has deteriorated. You know, we have got to retrain the CIA so that it's not just like a library and a research service. They used to be, in the Cold War, they used to be good at things like coup d'etats and assassinations and all the black arts that all the other intelligence communities in the world still do well. Our people don't do that very well. You know, we rely on the Department of Defense to do what should be done by clandestine services. Just look at this assassination of Soleimani, for example. It was done overtly. Our fingerprints are all over it. How come that had to be? You know, if these people were still good at doing their job, now I'm probably going to get in trouble because I'm a former CIA officer for saying this, all right?
But
we're not
it's
even
true.
Supposed to say this.
Blasphemer.
But it's a fact. You know, if they were good at their job.
It's true. Why didn't
President
they sneak
Trump,
in there?
The people should be wondering who did this. You know, there's all kinds of people in the Middle East that wanted Soleimani dead. The Israelis, his own rivals within Iran, the Iranian people, the IRGC guys knock each other off all the time for power. So, you know, a little subtlety is needed here. You know, we need a good intelligence service that knows how to do the black art operations.
They probably figured Adam Schiff was going to leak it anyway, so they might as well make a splash out of it.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. But since our guys are too incompetent to do it, the Israeli Mossad is one of the best in the world. You know, the Arab intelligence agencies are obviously very good. Nobody knows the area better than them. You know, we could provide resources to them to provide to the Iranian counter-revolutionary movement and, I think, solve this problem permanently.
Unfortunately,
I don't think that's what the State Department and the Department of Defense are thinking. You know, they're thinking about Iran as being kind of like a normal nation state and that, well, surely they're going to meet with us at the negotiating table now after we did this. Surely they're not going to want to escalate further. We'll get them to the negotiating table. I mean, they're doing the same thing with North Korea, not understanding how totalitarian states work, it seems to me. They're looking at things from a Western perspective, which is the mistake we always make. And this is the kind of miscalculation that can result in a disaster, but I do think there's a golden opportunity to solving this problem, at least where Iran is concerned, you know, that's been there for many years, staring us in the face. And, I guess that's my bottom line comment on this, that an appeal to, you know, to President Trump as he thinks about the future toward Iran. I know in his speech he said he does not seek regime change in Iran. Well, as the president, he has to say things like that. As the president, he has to say things like, well, America's military is second to none in the world. What's he going to do, go up there and say what I just said?
Right.
You know,
right.
That we've never been weaker and we're far behind the Russians? That would be crazy for a president, suicidal for a president who admits such a thing. So I'm hoping that behind closed doors, maybe he at least is thinking of these options. And I hope he realizes that the current advisors who are surrounding him, and I mean the State Department, the permanent State Department bureaucrats who advise him, and the intelligence community bureaucrats, you know, who are advising his leaders that are in charge of those organizations, you know, are part of the swamp, and they're the people that need to go, and he needs to get new creative people in there. you know, who can do this on the cheap, you know,
right,
and at the least possible risk to the United States.
Well, I just hope that they can put their politics aside and actually give him good advice, because I don't know.
It's always politics first. And
yeah, I mean, I think the first thing they want to do is see him fail. So how are they going to give him good advice with thinking that way? I mean, they're in a powerful position to give him some bad advice.
Yeah, that thought crossed my mind, too. You know, that maybe they're not interested in solving the problem, but they want to get him fired, too. If we do get into another big Middle Eastern war, it's going to very seriously hurt President Trump with his political base.
Sure.
Yeah, and then we can elect one of the other guys that's running, because they're all amazing. Okay.
And it's not necessary. It's not war. This is not necessary. You know, in the 19th century, and into the 20th century, into World War I and after, up until World War II, you know, Russia and Great Britain and France played what was called the Great Game in the Middle East, you know, where they advanced their interests, and protected their national security interests, which were considerable in the Middle East. It was just a handful of area specialists, people who knew the language, people who knew the tribes, people who had guns and money to spread around, and they didn't have to fight any wars. They didn't send their own armies in there to fight any of these wars. They could get the tribes to do it for them, or get them fighting each other, so that they didn't have to worry about that. And so with very few people, and at very low cost, they protected their interests for more than a century, advanced their interests for more than a century. And until the aftermath of World War I, I think it was around 1921, that the Sykes-Picot Agreement got translated into reality, and then they made the mistake of colonizing the Middle East, okay, which has led to all the problems we have today, you know, when the West actually established a big footprint and presence in the Middle East. You know, but we could go back to that, you know, if our intelligence community, you know, had the right people who know the languages, who knew the tribes, you know, it's going to take a long time to rebuild that.
Yeah.
But at least the allies, our allied intelligence agencies that are in there, that area,
yeah,
you know, have those capabilities right now. And we should be, that's the route we should take. We don't need to get one more Marine killed in Iran or anywhere, you know. You know, we need to take advantage of our allies. Let them pull, this is part of them pulling their weight, you know, to serve their own interests and our national security interests, and to do it in a way that keeps our fingerprints off of it and provides plausible deniability, you know?
I think that's a very well-made point, something that actually hadn't crossed my mind. Yeah, why didn't we get somebody else to do it? Dr. Pry, we are flat out of time yet again, but we've got to do a show on Russia. That's one subject we've skirted, and you're an expert, so we'd obviously love to have you back, and that's a great topic for us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, and I hope someday we can split a steak at the Black Bear.
There
Black
you
Bear
go.
Inn, right?
Well, there you
we'll,
go.
We'll have some Black Bear Diner food, a little free.
Black
free,
Bear Diner, that's right.
Free
that's
plug there. All right, we'll take care out there in Virginia, and we'll talk to you soon. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here at KCNR, 96.5 FM, 1460 AM.